Bacteria are becoming resistant to existing antibiotics at an alarming rate.
When we think about antibiotic resistance, we're not just talking about an inability to treat something like strep throat or a skin infection. We're talking about something that underpins pretty much every major medical advance of the last century.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, why researchers are using AI to find new antibiotics. Also, the Saudi crown prince used to be persona non grata in the U.S. That has changed.
You have a leader who is very keen on his development agenda for his country, and business needs peace.
Plus, Indonesia's new capital will have a palace overlooking the city. For 3 years, only VIPs have gotten in, but our reporter just got a tour.
Okay, we can go.
That story in the headlines today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is in Washington today, where he met with President Trump. It is the first time Mohammed bin Salman has been to the White House in 7 years.
Things happen, but he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that.
Trump there defending his guest today when a reporter asked about a moment that tested the relationship between the two countries in 2021. That's when the American intelligence community concluded that the Crown Prince likely ordered the operation that led to the killing of prominent Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But as the World's Shirin Jafari reports, today's visit suggests Mohammed bin Salman and the White House have moved on.
The two leaders smiled and shook hands, then posed for photos outside of the Oval Office. Military jets flew over the White House.
We have an extremely respected man in the Oval Office today, and a friend of mine for a long time, a very good friend of mine.
President Trump showered the Crown Prince with praise, saying that he's proud of the job that he's done, including when it comes to human rights. MBS, as the Crown Prince is known, smiled. Mohammed bin Salman is here not just to show that he's once again embraced by the world's most powerful leader. He's also come with a long wish list.
At the very top of that list is some kind of a defense agreement that would significantly upgrade the relationship with the United States.
Bilal Saab is a fellow with Chatham House and a managing director for a consulting firm called Trends US.
Cooperation on civilian nuclear issues and authorization by President Trump to sell the Saudis advanced fighter aircraft, including the F-35 fighter jet.
Trump has agreed to sell the kingdom the fighter jets. He clarified today that they will be similar to those that the Israelis have. Israel is our ally, so is Saudi Arabia, he said. The Saudis have also been interested in signing a security pact with the U.S. They want the U.S. to come to its defense if it's under attack. Bilal Saab doesn't see this type of arrangement as ideal.
I much prefer we have something that is mutual, where we have obligations towards the defense of the kingdom, and they have obligations as well towards the defense of American troops who are based not only in Saudi Arabia, but also in the region.
Yasmin Farouk, who's with the crisis group, says there's been a shift in bin Salman's approach in the region. In the past 7 years since he's been in power, he's had his country entangled in a bloody war with Yemen, imposed a blockade on Qatar, and severed ties with Iran. Today, she says, he has a different set of priorities.
You have a leader that today is very keen on stability in the region and who is very keen on focusing on his development agenda for his country, and business needs peace.
MBS has been on a mission to transform Saudi Arabia's economy. He wants his country to be less reliant on oil revenues. To do that, he is overseeing several mega projects that he hopes will bring in tourists and foreign investments. President Trump has his own interests in this meeting. He wants the Saudis to invest in the U.S., bringing in jobs.
President Trump is looking first and foremost for Saudi investments in the sectors that are crucial to the competition with China, and primarily, of course, the technology.
Trump said today that the Saudis will be investing $1 trillion in the U.S. economy. That number has been disputed, but the Crown Prince seemed to go along with the statement.
That the $600 billion will be $1 trillion.
Definitely, because what we are signing, it will facilitate that. And we will build on it.
Gregory Goss, visiting scholar at the Middle East Institute, says the U.S. president and his family have personal interests with the Saudis.
In many ways, the Trump administration in the first term and now is more like a Middle Eastern monarchy in the way it mixes state business and family business.
There are already several real estate deals involving the Trump Organization in Saudi Arabia, he says. The Trump Organization has ties to LIV Golf, which is backed by Saudi Arabia's public investment fund. A reporter asked the president today about his personal ties with the kingdom.
I have nothing to do with the family business. I have left, and when I've devoted 100% of my energy, what my family does.
Gregory Goss of the Middle East Institute sees today as a personal success for the Crown Prince. A few years ago, such a visit would have been unimaginable, he says. Human rights activists have criticized the Trump administration for receiving MBS. Today, Trump contradicted the U.S. intelligence report, saying that MBS had nothing to do with the murder of Saudi columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Things happen, Trump said. Yasmin Farouk of the Crisis Group says the Saudis and others in the region don't see the U.S. in a position to raise the issue of human rights.
After the wars that have been taking place in the Middle East and after what has been taking place in Gaza, it would be difficult to just talk about, you know, one situation without opening all the other files.
Trump and the Crown Prince will have dinner later tonight. The president said the dinner is funded through private money. He said there will be another dinner with the Crown Prince before he leaves office. And he said, quote, "It's going to be beautiful." For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In sparkling water news, a French court sided with Perrier today. According to the French newspaper Le Figaro, the legal question in the case was about what natural water really is. A consumer group had requested that the famous mineral water be pulled from shelves because the company was using a microfiltration process to remove contaminants. Perrier bottles water from aquifers near Vergès, France, where groundwater contamination is a known problem.
Last spring, when the court case began, water activist Bernard Schmidt told us here at The World that runoff from farms was a main culprit.
Plus de 30% de la surface est utilisée par des agriculteurs qui utilisent des pesticides.
Schmidt said the soil is porous, so rain can seep quickly into the groundwater and bring with it pesticides, animal feces, and bacteria.
The court case against Nestle-owned Perrier hinged on the company's practice of labeling the product natural, even though it's processed to remove those contaminants. In siding with Perrier today, the court explained that no harm to consumers was demonstrated.
The ruling might please a lot of people in Vergès. When the court case started last spring, bartender Fabien Verschave described what Perrier means to the area.
Perrier is very important to the village, he told us, adding that the company pays a lot of taxes to source its water here, and a lot of residents work at the factory.
Perrier produces about 1 billion bottles of bubbly water a year, thanks to the aquifers of Vergès.
1 billion bottles, mon Dieu, that's a lot of bubbles.
Every sport in the Winter Olympics must have one of two things, snow or ice. That's been the determining factor ever since the Winter Games began. Well, that rule is coming under scrutiny. Some officials are making the case for including one sport that does not require snow or ice, cross-country running. The World's Bianca Hillier explains.
What cross-country races lack in snow and ice, they often make up in mud.
There is a lot of mud being thrown at you. I mean, there are some athletes here that are absolutely caked with mud.
Runners race on grass, through the woods, and up and down hills. Inevitably, things get messy, and they wear spikes on their shoes to help with traction. Back in 1924, cross-country was part of the Summer Olympics, along with the rest of the running events. It's been left out ever since. But that could change if Seb Coe has his way. He's the president of World Athletics, the global governing body for running.
I would love to see cross-country back in the Olympic program. You know, thinking out of the box for a moment, why not include it in the Winter Olympic program?
Coe told the BBC about his master plan back in 2015 and has kept campaigning for it over the years, like in 2021 on the Sidious Mag podcast.
I will leave the sport very unhappy if I haven't got it back into the Olympic Games.
He's given a couple of reasons for why cross-country should be in the Winter Olympics. For one thing, climate change. The Summer Olympics keep getting hotter, and organizers keep having to make accommodations, like for the marathon in Tokyo in 2021.
6 a.m. start, an effort to avoid the heat of the afternoon sun, an earlier start than originally planned.
Of course, the Winter Olympics are also getting warmer, so Ko said on the podcast that mandatory snow or ice rule doesn't really hold up.
I've noticed the last few editions of the Winter Games being conspicuously lacking in snow and ice.
But the main reason Ko points to is that putting cross-country into the Winter Olympics would make them much more diverse. Specifically, it would be a major opportunity for many African countries, which often send very few athletes, if any, to the Winter Games. Just 13 people represented the continent in 2018, and only 6 did in 2022. But runners from Africa dominate in cross-country.
It is brilliant running from Jacob Kiplimo.
Athletes from Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya swept the men's and women's podiums at the cross-country world championships last year. In fact, you have to go back almost 20 years to find a world champion from outside those three countries. Many of the top cross-country runners do compete in the summer games, but adding Winter Olympian to their legacy would be a big deal, says Abisa Negese, an agent representing Ethiopia. Runners.
I think it's a good idea. And once they are participating in the Winter Olympics, that means they get a lot of chances to show their performance and to get the sponsorship.
Sabrina Samada is on board too.
Sabrina Samada of Kenya leaves the start hub, the 19-year-old.
In 2018, she became the first alpine skier to represent Kenya at the Winter Games and says it's one of her biggest dreams to have more Africans join her there, even if they're not competing on snow or ice.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a cool idea. I hope that people from Africa get more. I hope that we are growing.
Samada says, as a winter sport athlete, getting support from the Kenyan Olympic Committee has been tough. And earlier this year, she made the difficult decision to step away from professional skiing because she couldn't come up with the money.
The past 11 years, I tried my best to keep going with my sponsors financially to build up the budget every season. But it was really stressful because I wasn't just an athlete. I was also kind of a manager and boss.
So a few months ago, she called it quits. Still, Samada hopes that having Kenyan cross-country runners in the Winter Games could help beef up the country's support for all of their Winter Olympians. If cross-country running were to be added to the winter lineup, it wouldn't happen until at least 2030. But it is gaining traction now. Sarah Hirschland, CEO of the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, told me that innovating in this way makes a lot of sense to her.
I think we have to give SEB and World Athletics a lot of credit for pushing the envelope and trying to stay at the forefront of thinking differently about how to present their sport. So we're excited. You can bet we're going to be right there trying to be competitive.
The idea also has a chance because the International Olympic Committee has a new president, Kirsty Coventry of Zimbabwe. She's been clear that she wants to increase African representation at the Games, and she's created a working group that is in part considering if traditional summer sports could cross over into winter. But a large group of people are saying slow down. The Winter Olympic Federations, which govern the winter sports, released a joint statement last week condemning the idea. They said adding a summer sport to the Winter Games would dilute the brand, heritage, and identity that make the Winter Olympics unique, and that they should continue celebrating sports practiced on snow and ice. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The problem of bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics is well known. Just ahead, a researcher gives us hope and a roadmap for solving that problem. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. 1 in 6 lab-confirmed bacterial infections were resistant to antibiotics in 2023. That is according to the World Health Organization. Medical researchers are in a race to develop new antibiotics as bacteria becomes resistant to old ones. And they're harnessing artificial intelligence to help. One research project in the UK plans to spend nearly $60 million on the quest to take on superbugs. Andrew Edwards is a member of the UK research team at Imperial College London.
We're facing a twin threat of rising antibiotic resistance and a lack of new drugs in development. So whilst the bacteria are quickly becoming more and more resistant, we're running out of options to tackle them very quickly.
And that comes with a big human cost, right?
Absolutely. So many of your listeners will have taken a course of antibiotics, and for the most part, that's something quite sort of mild. But lots of people take antibiotics to allow them to have cancer chemotherapy or to survive invasive surgical procedures or the survival of preterm infants is utterly dependent upon antibiotics. So when we think about antibiotic resistance, we're not just talking about an inability to treat something like strep throat or a skin infection. We're talking about something that underpins pretty much every major medical advance of the last century.
And something like 1 million people die a year from antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And it's only getting worse.
Here's another thing that I was surprised to learn. The last time a new class of antibiotics hit the market was almost 40 years ago. Why does it take so long to find and develop new ones?
Yeah, so we got very good at finding new antibiotics in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And so, as you've just explained, a lot of the antibiotics we use nowadays are really very, very old. And you compare that with lots of other medical advances, such as, you know, the fat-busting jabs that we're all familiar with, you know, very new advances. Antibiotics are generally pretty old. And in some ways, they're victims of their own success. So back in the sort of 60s and 70s, we had loads of them. Resistance wasn't really a problem. There wasn't much point looking for new ones. And in some respect, we've sort of lost our way a little bit in trying to find new ones. So we need to really make up for lost time and fast forward the development of new drugs.
Is that because they're not lucrative for drug companies to make? I mean, is this a business issue here?
Partly, yes. There is a financial hurdle. If you think about lots of new drugs, you know, if you think about things you might take for blood pressure or diabetes, these are medicines that you take once or twice a day for decades. So there's pretty good returns in those. Whereas antibiotics, particularly new drugs, the more we use them, the less effective they become. So they have to be locked away and only used very sparingly for the most serious cases. So putting it bluntly, there's not really much money to be made from them.
All right. So let's get to the news here today. How are you going to use AI to help?
Right. So all bacteria or all bacteria that cause infection have different types of resistance, but the ones that we're really going after are what are known as gram-negative bacteria. So this includes things like E. coli that might cause a urinary tract infection. And this type of bacteria have a very special outer coat that's really, really difficult to get through to get drugs into the cell to kill the bacteria.
So it's hard for the antibiotic to actually get into the heart of the cell.
That's right. And even if we can get something in, these bacteria also have these little molecular pumps that can pump out any antibiotics that do make it through the outer shell. So what we want to do is understand the chemical tricks that we can use to get new antibiotics into the cell and keep them in the cell long enough for them to kill the bacteria. And we don't really have a good handle on what those chemical tricks are yet. So what we need to do is basically throw a huge range of different chemicals at bacteria and then very carefully measure which ones get in, which ones don't. And then we use that huge volume of data to feed our AI models. And AI is really, really good at picking up patterns that would otherwise take decades for humans to spot. Look at those patterns, figure out the tricks that we think are important. Then we go back into the lab and we test those models. And what we hope is that after a few rounds of data and AI and data and AI, we learn the chemical tricks and we can apply those to new antibiotics that get in the cell, stay in the cell, and then kill the bacterial pathogen.
So that sounds like an important first step, but you know, discovering this new chemical or compound is one thing, and then making sure it's safe for humans, it works in the human body, developing the drug, testing the drug, those are a lot of very time-consuming and expensive steps, too. So how much is using AI at this early first step likely to actually impact the end result, this providing a line of defense against antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. The most expensive way to fail in this process is when you start testing in humans. So we want to avoid that. So in addition to looking at the chemical signatures, the chemical tricks that will help us kill bacteria, at the same time, we're going to be throwing the same chemicals at human cells. And we're going to select against all of the chemical tricks that damage the human cells. So this doesn't mean that we're not going to test things. Always, always have to test the safety and efficacy profile of new drugs. But what it does mean is that hopefully we can avoid coming up with anything that is overtly toxic in those early stages and thus maximize the chances that when things go forward into human trials, they have the best chance of success.
Mm. But there is no AI workaround for, you know, the various phases of human trials and all those expensive and time-intensive steps.
There's no workaround. I mean, ultimately, you have to put it in people and do that very, very carefully to check the safety. But AI can help predict some of the properties of those small molecules. It might tell us whether, you know, we think it's going to be able to be used in a pill form or has to be used in an injection. So I think there's an opportunity for AI to help speed up that process. But fundamentally, safety testing is not going to be affected by this. We still have to do that very carefully, very slowly and methodically.
So what is the pace of this race between bacteria and antibiotics? Like, how many new antibiotics do we need to develop to stay ahead of these superbugs for the next, I don't know, century or something like that?
I mean, the thing about the bacteria is they are literally evolving. If we think about drugs for every other type of disease, once you've got a good treatment for, say, diabetes or blood pressure or depression, that tends to be a good medicine for a long time. It can be improved, but it's pretty stable. Drug resistance, on the other hand, is a constantly evolving and shifting threat. I would never say that we would have enough antibiotics, but we're definitely well behind the curve at the moment. We need to be producing a significant number of new drugs year on year for several years to get ahead of the curve and then have a program in place to keep developing this, because it's no good having, let's say, 10 or 15 new drugs and then sitting back and thinking we've solved the problem. We have to have a sustainable pipeline for decades to come.
Is that realistic if there hasn't been a new drug in 40 years?
I'm an optimist. The reason I get out of bed in the morning, apart from having to pay the mortgage, is because I really believe that this is a really big threat and that we can make good progress against it.
Andrew Edwards is a microbiologist and a member of the UK team harnessing AI to try to attack antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Just ahead, a behind-the-scenes look at a new palace in Indonesia's new capital city. That's coming up. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. On the lush Indonesian island of Borneo, a new national capital is being built. It's called Nusantara, and it's designed to withstand the pressures of climate change. It will replace the current capital, Jakarta, which is sinking underwater. Much of Nusantara is a construction site, though the downtown is already taking shape. There's also a big palace built to pay tribute to Indonesia. Reporter Patrick Nguyen was the first foreign journalist to get a look inside the palace. Here is what he found.
You might think Indonesia's state palace, the most grandiose building in the country, would be buzzing with tourists. But there are only a few here, gazing from a distance through a locked gate. It is gorgeous, says an Indonesian tourist named Sarah to her friend. They say they've never seen anything like it. And fair enough. Because the most striking thing about this palace complex is a towering metallic bird blocking out part of the sky. It's taller than the Statue of Liberty, with a wingspan wider than a football field. The only other tourist here, Krishna, who, like many Indonesians, goes by one name, says he heard it's all made of copper. Krishna says the bird will eventually turn green, right? Just like the Statue of Liberty. If Indonesians still seem mystified by the state palace and its bird monument, it is pretty new. Construction kicked off 3 years ago with a solemn blessing by the man who commissioned it, former President Joko Widodo.
Selamat pagi, salam sejahtera bagi kita semuanya, Om Swastiastu.
It was completed late last year. The palace is the centerpiece of a new city, Nusantara, Indonesia's utopian, eco-friendly future capital, being built in Borneo's remote hills. I came here determined to see not just the bird, but inside the palace itself, a stately building at the bird's feet, cradled by its wings. At first, local officials said, sorry, VIPs only. But eventually, they let me in.
Okay, we can go move forward.
Wow. Every square inch is ornate, starting with the doors, made of cinnamon-colored wood. And they're tall enough for a giraffe to walk through. Eko Subianto is a security officer showing me around. He says the doors are wooden on the outside, but inside it's heavy steel, bulletproof. This place is a fortress, a very luxurious fortress. We're standing on a floor made from this iridescent stone called Lemurian blue. It scintillates in the light with psychedelic blues and greens, like the Aurora Borealis. This exotic stone comes from Madagascar, but that is just about the only thing in here that's imported.
Untuk istana negara ini, 98% materialnya lokal.
Eko says 98% of what you see was made by the great sons and daughters of Indonesia. He shows me ballrooms made with pearl-colored marble from the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, and rooms lined with hardwood where artists from Bali have carved the faces of national heroes. Over our heads are chandeliers with long tendrils twinkling like crystal jellyfish, all locally made, just like that humongous copper bird monument outside.
Ini istana negara, kalau dilihat dari atas ini seperti gunung, burung Garuda.
Eko explains that the bird is a Garuda, not a real animal, but a mythical creature. A Garuda is like a supernaturally huge eagle, and Indonesia's government has long promoted it as a national symbol, a symbol to unite all 280 million Indonesians living on thousands of islands, speaking many languages, and worshiping different gods. But the Garuda monument has drawn mixed reviews. A while back, one of the lead architects of this new capital city, a man named Sibarani Sofian, told me it was the former president's idea to create a monument shaped like an animal, not his.
Probably, the last time I see it, it's probably the Egyptian during the pharaoh, right?
He's referring to the Egyptian Sphinx, another monument shaped like a mythical creature. Sibarani also said that when this monument was unveiled and people saw this metal bird hunkering on a green hill, it drew comparisons to Batman's lair, the Batcave.
Because it does look like that. It's so dark. It's black, although they say that it will be green one day.
The inside of the palace does have a more dazzling look, with shimmery lights and rich hardwood. Eko, the security officer, says that hidden away is the president's chambers. The current president, Prabowo Subianto, is supposed to move in by 2028. Don't think that just because it's pretty, this palace isn't solid, says Eko, rapping hard on one of the pillars holding up the ceiling. It's a teak wood beam weighing 3 tons.
Solid. Utuh.
For now, the only people who've seen this place are the people who built it, lots of Indonesian officials, and a handful of foreign VIPs. I tell Eko, coming from the U.S., a country that takes an eternity to build anything, the most astonishing thing about this place is it was finished in 2 years.
Dan ada yang bilang ini kalau dibikin di negara saya belum tentu 2 tahun itu selesai.
Eko says, yeah, other Western visitors have said that too. Everyday Indonesians still don't know when they'll get to see the inside of this palace, only that eventually the government intends to offer tours. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Nusantara, Indonesia.
Vegemite is a human right. That's the claim a prison inmate in Australia is taking to court.
54-year-old Andre McKechnie is serving a life sentence for murder in Victoria. He is claiming that the prison policy forbidding Vegemite is a violation of his right to, quote, enjoy his culture as an Australian.
Vegemite, if you're wondering, is the polarizing, yeasty food spread widely loved or at least defended across Australia, where it's estimated that 80% of households have a jar of the stuff in the pantry. But in prison, that's a different matter.
Vegemite has been banned from the penitentiaries of Victoria for nearly 20 years. That's because its strong odor confuses drug-sniffing police dogs. This court case is scheduled for trial next year.
Mercury pollution. It's very toxic, and one of the biggest culprits of it is small-scale gold mining, where mercury is used to separate gold from rock and soil. That's a problem for the environment and for the health of gold miners. Our partners at the DW program, Living Planet, looked into some projects in Peru that are trying to get miners to stop using mercury while also trying to rehabilitate parts of the Amazon rainforest where they're mining for gold. Here's reporter Kathleen Schuster.
The thing is that Mercury's long journey through South American history has been sped up with the help of the Interoceanic Highway. This highway runs from Peru's Pacific coast east through the Amazon and then back down to Brazil's Atlantic coast. It was built in the middle of a gold rush that's seen gold production across the globe jump by 55% between 1995 and 2018. And these two developments have spurred on even more people to flock to gold rush towns, especially to the epicenter of alluvial gold mining, a region called Madre de Dios in the Peruvian Amazon.
It was ready, I think, 2012. Many, many people that before came here, maybe you take, I don't know, 3 days, 4 days. Now they can go here in, I don't know, 8 hours, 10 hours by the highway. It's a very, very easy way to come here, no?
Franz Cabanillas is a forestry engineer, and he's also a project coordinator for a nonprofit called Pure Earth. He says the miners coming in droves to Madre de Dios are from impoverished communities. For them, dealing with mercury is a risk many are willing to take to earn good money. Peru is currently South America's biggest gold producer. Its poverty rate hovers around 25%, meaning one in four doesn't earn much more than the equivalent of $100 a month. So the prospect of getting $60 for just one single gram of gold is a good one. One approach to put the brakes on this trend has been to ban mercury, but if anything, that's just made sellers and buyers turn to the black market. Mario Rodas works with a global initiative called Planet Gold, and one project they've slowly started to roll out works to show miners how much money they're losing by using mercury.
What is happening right now is that an artisanal miner go to a plant with their mineral, the plant perform an analysis, and if they have 10 grams of gold per ton of mineral, the plant tells them that they have 6. So they go to the plant.
Essentially, what's happening is the miners are losing money left and right. There's the processing fee, and then because mercury is fast but not very thorough, there's some gold left over in the waste byproduct called the tailing that now belongs to the plant. According to Mario, the miners end up losing about 60% of their earnings. So the project Mario's working on is trying to create a better deal. They get miners to sell the ore to processing plants that are mercury-free. And in exchange, a lab analysis tells the miners exactly how much gold they have, and they get a bigger cut.
We are telling them from the beginning, you have 10. The plant will pay them for 7, for example, because they need to process. But in that deal, they are earning 3 more than they were used to earn, right? And they are not spending money and time in paying the plant and the mercury and processing the mineral. So that's the alternative we give.
He says they've started with 2 or 3 artisanal gold miners, and their program is growing and stands to become policy in Ecuador in the future. Cutting down on mercury use is the only sure way to reduce these emissions. But what about the long-term impact from mercury exposure? Studies on minors' health have been limited because minors tend to be reluctant to come forward. But there was a 2016 study by researchers from Duke University in the U.S. They took hair samples from hundreds of people living along the Inner Oceanic Highway, the Madre de Dios River, and also from 2,000 people from a local indigenous reserve. They found that 40% of the residents had mercury levels above the maximum recommended by the World Health Organization. And then the next picture is...
Okay, the first one, you can see a very, very...
Franz Cabanillas says one of the solutions they've been working on together is reforesting the Amazon. It's hard to look at his pictures and not notice the catastrophic impact of this vicious vector of deforestation, gold mining, and mercury contamination on a fragile ecosystem like the Amazon.
It was a primary forest in the beginning, but now you can see... a reforestation process that we did, that plantation we did in February of 2023. Okay, in the second picture, you can see a Chihuahuaco tree is like considered.
The picture shows a worker standing on a large plot of saplings spaced about 2 meters apart. He's holding on to a fragile sapling with one hand, and in the other hand, a red canister. These are Chihuahuaco trees. Chihuahuaco trees are the ancient giants of the Amazon. They can grow up to 60 meters tall, and the oldest ones are said to be more than 1,000 years old.
It's like considered a very, very important tree in the Amazon. It's like a very representative species in the Amazon. No? And you can see that it grows in that kind of land with different also ingredients that we put in the soil. It's not like the sand by themselves give that nutrients to the Chihuahuaco tree, no?
But yeah, looking at this, I mean, it looks like you're planting trees on a beach. That's what the soil looks like. It doesn't look anything like what I would associate with really rich soil in the Amazon in this.
Exactly. It's difficult, but yes, it is we can do that. Okay? It's possible, no? But
the soil found in rainforests is very low in nutrients. The Amazon, for example, relies on fungi and bacteria to decompose organic matter like dead plants and animals. So once the forest is destroyed, all that's left is sandy soil. The good news, he says, is that reforestation can work, but in this case requires at least 3 years of intensive care, which raises the question, why not just try to ban deforestation? He says this would create other problems.
If we think to ban, for example, the formal sector here in Madre de Dios, I am sure that you can have a very, very strong socio-political conflict that maybe never can solve. No, it's a very, very risk to think about that. And also because it's a legal activity. Okay, if we talk about the concessions, it's a legal activity. It's like, is this in the legal context, it's the same if I have a mining concession or if I have a forestry concession or if I have an ecotourism concession, it's the same. It's the same category because all that activities are legal with authorization of the government.
Which is why part of the solution he's been working on is to create incentives for formal miners. The first is that they help certify the miners to use non-mercury methods, like the shaking table. This method isolates the gold powder using water and a mechanized table that shakes. It takes about an hour, so twice as long as mercury, but it's non-toxic, and the miners are more likely to get better yields. The other is that they involve the miners in the reforestation process. He says these men and women often don't come from the region, and so once they're included in caring for the forest, their connection to the Amazon begins to grow too. And another benefit, Cabanillas and other researchers from Pure Earth showed in a 2022 study, was that reforestation did in fact help prevent mercury from reaching the watershed. There's one elephant in the room left to address. A golden elephant, if you will. And that's, where is this gold ending up? The answer is unfortunately not straightforward. Artisanal and small-scale gold mining is not illegal per se, and there are many miners who work within the bounds of the law across South America or find themselves in a gray zone. But it is a sector struggling to disentangle itself from organized crime, human exploitation, and international money laundering, especially amid widespread poverty, corruption, and gold prices that continue to rise.
Kathleen Schuster reporting there about the health and environmental impacts of using mercury for small-scale gold mining. She reported the story for Living Planet, a program from our partners at DW, Deutsche Welle. Find more of their work wherever you get your podcasts.
The COP30 climate summit is still underway, and the host country, Brazil, is urging countries to get more ambitious in their climate plans. Some of the big issues still being debated this week at the climate summit, pledges for climate aid, and honest reporting about the progress countries are making on climate goals. Check out our coverage of the UN climate summit at theworld.org and listen this week as we report on the takeaways from the conference. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In this next story, a daughter recounts her search into her family's past. Karen Kirsten had grown up hearing an incredible saga from her mother's childhood, but she could never quite confirm the details or piece them together in a way that made sense. So she set out on something of a pilgrimage to investigate. Kirsten described her search for answers on the GBH program Stories from the Stage.
I'm sitting in the back of a Toyota Corolla on the outskirts of Warsaw in Poland. I'm Jewish, and wedged next to me is an 83-year-old, 5-foot, extremely plump nun. My mother had spent part of World War II in a Catholic orphanage in a town in central Poland. And at 69, from Australia, she asked me to help her find the sisters who'd cared for her. I emailed dozens of churches. I searched for the sisters for months. And just when I was about to give up, a friend in Boston, where I live, introduced me to a man in Poland who was well connected in Catholic circles. And he phoned Sister Honorata. And she told him about a little Jewish girl her order had hidden during the war. So in the car, I'm feeling hopeful because Sister Honorata is wearing a polyester cream shirt, a black calf-length skirt, Birkenstock type sandals with white socks. And Mum had told me that her sisters wore skirts and shirts, not head-to-toe habits. But I'm feeling skeptical still, because whenever Mum shared her memories with me, I would research them, and sometimes the dates didn't line up and the details were different. Plus, she'd been in Poland 10 years earlier, searching for the sisters and couldn't find them. Finally, we get out of the traffic snarls and we're on the open highway and the sister driving turns up her Catholic pop tunes. Hours later, and we pull into a gravel driveway, and behind a convent painted daffodil yellow is this enormous old wooden building, the orphanage my mother had described. After my grandmother was killed, my mother's aunt and uncle took care of her somewhere close to here. And when she was 18 months old, they were arrested and sent to an extermination camp. And they left her wailing in her cot, holding her white teddy bear. And at some point, she was taken later to the convent. Mum had told me about these enormous mountains behind the orphanage. I don't see any mountains, just a grassy knoll. Mum was 3 and a half when she left here. How could a child possibly remember anything accurately? Suddenly, sisters start popping out of the yellow building and they rush to the car, including the Mother Superior, who, like Sister Honorata, was close friends with a sister who took care of the little Jewish girl, supposedly my mother. But no one's left alive who knew her. But the stories about the girl are legendary here. Mother Superior tells me that the little Jewish girl didn't live with the 75 older children in the orphanage, but they kept her hidden. She slept with Sister Cornelia in her room above where I'm sitting now. And she also tells me that Nazi officers interrogated and killed Jewish people in a building at the rear of the property, and that the little girl was fascinated by their tall jackboots. Fascinated? I'm pretty sure the woman who's translating has made a mistake. Mum had told me about her nightmares of men in uniform with black boots, and the Gestapo men who came for my grandmother that day wore boots. There's no way this child they're talking about could be my mother. So I pull out my laptop and I show the sisters a photo taken close to here of my mother in a white bonnet tucked into a stroller. Mother Superior looks at it and then she reaches into a cabinet and she hands me a picture of a sister holding this scrawny, pale, sick-looking child. I've wasted my time. This doesn't look anything like the child on my laptop. But then I notice the bonnet. It's too big. Could it be, if my mother hadn't had enough to eat before she was eventually taken to the convent, could it be her? Mother Superior hands me another picture. This one taken at the end of the war of a little girl, 3.5, 4 years old, with a full round face, glossy black hair, dark chocolate eyes. This looks like photos I've seen of me as a child. We line this photo up to the one on my laptop. This is my mother, and these are her nuns. 5 months after I hug the sisters goodbye, I return with my mother from Australia. And after a long day at the convent, I follow her into the chapel and I watch her slide into a pew. Sisters file in for afternoon prayers and then they stop and they stare at my mother, the little girl they've all heard about. I watch Mum's face switch from frowning to smiling, like she's vacillating between the past and the present. She's listening to the sisters chant this low, soothing rhythm, mantras she heard here morning, midday, and night. Now I can picture her. Outside, there's the violence of war, and inside, a routine that anchors a child who's lost everyone she loves. Mum flew 30,000 miles here to reconcile memories that have haunted her for years. She laughed at the mountains that turned out to be hills, but the old pews that she'd sat on for hours, swinging her legs while Sister Cornelia prayed, they are real. And so are my mother's memories, even with their inconsistencies. I know Mum is at home here now. It's as if, for the first time, I know who she is. Thank you.
Karen Kirsten shared her mother's story with GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. Our reporting is also on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.